Good morning. May it please the court, counsel, Assistant Federal Public Defender Laura Quint, representing the appellant, Wendell Harris Rory. What may have begun as a consensual encounter in this case between Mr. Harris Rory and the police escalated into an illegal seizure. The permissible encounter became an impermissible seizure when the officers made Mr. Harris Rory's departure conditional upon his compliance with their request for identification. Do you have ID, they said, and you can be on your way.
The government says that issue was waived.
Your Honor, we dispute that the issue
Why?
Is waived because the issue before the court below, as it is here, was surrounded the totality of circumstances and focused on the distinction between a consensual encounter and an impermissible seizure.
But counsel for the defendant never argued in the district court that the request for the ID is what began the search, right? The stop. That's what was the stop.
Well, below, Your Honor, what we argued was under a totality of circumstances approach, a reasonable person.
But the district court never had an opportunity to rule on the issue you're raising here.
To the extent that we're raising anything differently here than we raised below, if anything, we're abandoning or conceding a part of the argument and focusing on one particular fact in a progression of facts, each of which were before the district court and each of which was important. Under a totality of circumstances approach, this fact was certainly before the court. It's not new, it's not a novel fact, and if anything, court counsel below did not emphasize a particular fact or application of law to a particular fact, but it was certainly one of many facts available to the court making up a totality of circumstances.
So you're really arguing that the buzzword totality of the circumstances means that between trial and appeal, an appellant can shift the whole focus of facts within the totality?
This fact was available to the court.
But did he argue?
That's always true in plain error. It's available, right? Availability is not enough.
We would argue that we did not waive it because the issue was always whether it was a consensual encounter or the distinction, the nebulous threshold between a consensual encounter and an impermissible seizure. And just as we argue here, below we argued that what may have begun as a consensual encounter escalated or became an impermissible seizure before the flight took place.
Well, if you're going to use a new emphasis or a new argument, then it seems to me that you also have to refute an argument that necessarily arises given your new stance, and that is, forget about whether this individual could be stopped as a suspect to the crime. There's D.C. law and law in other jurisdictions that say when there's a violent crime that's afoot and there's an individual who's a witness, a potential important witness, that you can stop that person and for at least a limited period of time and get their identification and ask them questions about what they saw and what they heard. So if the police stopped this individual when they asked him for his ID, so what? It's constitutional in the District of Columbia and other jurisdictions.
We're not disputing at all that the police can approach someone, ask questions, even ask for identification.
And even stop them from leaving.
Your Honor, when they made there was no indication that Mr. Harris Roy was involved in any crime whatsoever.
No, that's not the point. But he was there at a point where the gunshots were heard, so he is a very important potential witness. And the law is that under the Fourth Amendment, forget about suspects or anything else, you could stop somebody from, if they're a potential witness to a violent crime, you can stop them from leaving and you can get their identification. It makes perfect sense. You just, somebody sees somebody kill somebody, they just can't, the police come on the scene, they just can't walk away.
You know, the police could absolutely approach Mr. Harris Rory, but Mr. Harris Rory signaled clearly by rolling up the windows in his car, by locking the car door, by complaining of harassment, that he did not want anything to do with the police.
But that's
the police,
not his choice. If he's a witness to a crime, that is not his choice. Even the restatement, the treatises, I looked this up, it says that if the officer has reasonable cause to believe that a felony involving danger has been committed, the officer, and that the individual has knowledge of that would aid the investigation, then it's reasonable for the officer to stop the person and get the person's identification and ask and get them to account for the crime.
There is no indication here whatsoever in the record that Mr. Harris-Roy was a witness to the crime or knew any more than he was.
There is evidence, because instead of saying when he was asked about the shots, I didn't hear anything, which would have perhaps made him a non-witness, although since he was so close, one would have a question. He didn't say, he said, I didn't have anything to do with it, implicitly acknowledging that he had heard it, so he was a witness.
He did say, I didn't have anything to do with it. However, he rolled up the windows to his car again. He locked the door. He complained of police harassment. He clearly signaled to the officers that he wanted nothing to do with them. They persisted, despite the fact they were making no advances in asking him questions.
There's a case called Williamson versus the United States in the District of Columbia Court of Appeals that is almost exactly the same thing happened. There were gunshots. There was an individual in a car, the police went and they stopped them, and so on and so forth. And it's exactly the same. And as a matter of fact, one of the arguments that the individual there made was that, well, I didn't want to cooperate, and if you wanted my identification, you could have just taken my license plate number down. And the D.C. Court of Appeals, this is 92, rejected it.
Your Honor, the government and its opposition to our brief didn't raise this line of questioning at all.
I'm just saying that if you're permitted to now change the focus and say that there was a seizure as a result of the request for identification, then it seems to me that you have to counter a new argument against you, which is that the police are perfectly entitled to stop somebody and get their identification if they're a potential witness.
Again, we submit that we're not changing the argument. The focus was always on whether he was seized before the flight, which obviously would have permitted the officers to seize him.
Let me take you back to the waiver issue, if I could. Do you agree that if it is waived, we have no jurisdiction to even hear the argument? Not even
we submit that it's not waived. However, if the court found that it was, we would argue that it should review the case on plain error.
Richard, really? You're mixing waiver and forfeiture.
Yeah. What about this Weathers case that you all cite? Doesn't that specifically say that we have no jurisdiction over it?
I believe the Weathers case has to do with timing, and our argument is that under Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 12E, we certainly raised the issues and put the court on notice that we were challenging the seizure in a timely fashion and raised it before trial. Nothing new. Mm-hmm. Nothing was left for trial. I believe that's what the Weathers case stands for. And we certainly gave the court notice that we were challenging the seizure on Fourth Amendment grounds in a timely fashion.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Mr. Harris-Roy was, the show of authority came when the police made a request of Mr. Harris-Roy, specifically the request for identification, and created an impression that compliance with that request was compelled. And the show of authority.
That's one reading of the testimony. It's quite clearly not the reading that the district court gave it. The district court gave the next sentence, we're not holding you, what seems to be a natural reading as part of what the officer was describing as what he said to the defendant.
Well, interesting.
You say in your reply brief, it was clear that it was just the officer summing up his own testimony for the court. That's certainly not clear to me, and it's obviously not the way the court read it.
Well, notably, even the government in its opposition said that the officer appeared to say at the motions hearing that he had told the defendant, Mr. Harris-Roy, we're not holding you here or anything. To me, the change in pronouns clearly signals that what the officer was doing at the motions hearing is telling the court we weren't holding him there or anything like that. He addressed Mr. Harris-Roy as him, whereas in citing what he had actually said to Mr. Harris-Roy, he said, do you have ID and you can be on your way? And then he switched and said to the court we weren't holding
him
there.
That's a subtle reading of the pronouns, and who knows, it may be correct, but I don't think it's the way the trial court understood it, and I would have a hard time calling that plain error.
The trial court...
I'm sorry. Did you have a reply?
Not on that point, Your Honor.
Did he leave the keys in the car when he ran away?
I think the transcript is unclear in several places, including that. I know the keys were in the ignition. That seems to be undisputed.
Well, he was putting the windows up and down with power windows so that, I guess he had the car on.
The engine was running, wasn't it?
The engine was running.
That was part of his argument.
The engine was running when the police approached.
That's why he said it was a traffic stop.
I think the traffic stop analogy was to indicate that a reasonable person in that situation, behind the wheel when driving is a regulated and privileged activity, wouldn't feel free to leave when the police, unlike a pedestrian perhaps, when the police ask for identification. That was the purpose of bringing up the traffic stop analogy. I believe the record's unclear. Yes, Your Honor. The court below found that when Mr. Harris Rory telephoned his mother, he was going about his business. We would submit it's exactly the opposite. He was not planning on calling his mother. The engine was running. It was a late hour. And the entire topic of the conversation with his mother was the police presence. So it was a direct result of the police actions that led to Mr. Harris Rory.
His mother's car.
That's correct. Phoning his mother, staying in place, and thereby submitting, at least initially, rather than going on his way. By staying in the car, by phoning his mother, who owned the vehicle, he was submitting to the show of authority, which was a conditional request for identification.
They didn't ask for his driver's license. They didn't ask for the registration of the car.
They asked, as far as the record states, they asked for identification in general, nothing more specific than that.
Okay. Thanks.
Good morning. Suzanne Nyland for the United States. As the court has alluded to, we have argued and do maintain that there has been a waiver of this argument here in the Court of Appeals because, as the court's noted, the one phrase of the officer's testimony on which his entire appeal rests is ambiguous at best. The trial court or district court was not focused on it and wasn't asked to find if, in fact, the appellate was told, essentially, give me your ID and I'll let you go, or words to the effect of creating that condition.
Does 12E refer to the fast-moving sequence of events at a suppression hearing? It looks to me as if it deals with a situation where the court says, well, motions must be filed by the 30th of March, and the motion isn't filed, therefore it's waived. That's a waiver. Thus the talk of deadlines, while the defendant actually doesn't know exactly what the officers are going to say, right?
It would be
quite demanding to insist that his motion to suppress specified the exact sort of vulnerability of the testimony that he doesn't yet know.
Well, I would agree with that. In this context, and the district court recognized that it was a very general motion. However, at the motions hearing, where they had a chance to develop the grounds for their motion upon hearing the testimony of the police officer, they had a number of very specific grounds.
I see your point there, and that seems to me to point towards forfeiture and plain error. But I'm just questioning whether 12E really applies to that context at all.
Well, we think that it does, but we've relied on the Breshorn case from the First Circuit to argue that. I don't think we had one from this circuit, and I think the difficulty presented by hearing this claim here is that now appellant is putting forward what is essentially a factual argument. There's a factual dispute between us as to what the officer meant by that one phrase.
But plain error gives you a lot of protection against that, right?
And therefore, on the alternative, we'd rely on plain error. And it appears that appellant agrees that is the standard that applies. Candidly, we did not look at Williamson and this notion that he could have been stopped, flat-out stopped, unquestionably seized, based on being a witness to a crime. So unfortunately, I can't speak to that. I'm not sure, based on this record, how that would apply. But I do know, and we've argued based on this record, that even if there wasn't that ground for affirmance that the court has alluded to, that there was no show of authority here sufficient to.
Don't you find it rather strange that the reason the police had probable cause to arrest him is that he ran away, and your argument that he wasn't arrested before he ran away because he could have driven away?
Yes, except that the distinction here is that he bails out of the car and takes off when they are still investigating in an area which is known for guns, drugs, and there have just been gunshots fired. So it's his flight on foot.
If he drove away, the same argument would apply, wouldn't it?
It wouldn't, but we wouldn't be in Wardlow territory if he had driven away either. And I do think that distinction is important because in this particular instance, the officer certainly had a valid event to be investigating and had not issued any orders to him. And yes, he could have driven away under our scenario, not taking Williamson into account.
That would have made him suspicious if he's driving away, just like running away.
I don't know that I'm familiar with any case law that would draw that distinction. I'm not sure that he could simply drive, or that driving away would be different, because Wardlow is limited, it seems to me, on its facts. I mean, he hasn't engaged in any kind of traffic offense here. There's no stop here of a traffic offense kind of nature. There's no complying with any kind of court, any kind of police demand and then taking
if
off in
the
car.
Squealing, with the tire squealing, it would be running.
Yeah.
The automotive equivalent of running.
Well, the automotive equivalent of running.
In a stately way, it's not.
Well,
I
can see the court's point, but that's kind of where Wardlow leaves us, doesn't it? You know, versus walking away at a normal pace versus running. The walking, the police can't stop you. The running, they can. We have this dilemma. In any event, I would not belabor the court's time on this, except to say that we still maintain that there was no show of authority here. And even if the court thought there was any question about that, there certainly wasn't any compliance with any arguable command by the police, and we see no such command that would have created a seizure in this circumstance, and we would ask for affirmance under the agreed-upon plain error standard. Thank you.
I'll give you a minute.
With respect to the waiver issue, the government raised the case of Bacharoun. And in that case, the defense raised an entire new line of defense or argument. Their theory.
Is that the First Circuit case?
The First Circuit case. Uh-huh. That's correct, Your Honor. At the district court level, the defense argued that none of the officers involved in the arrest of the defendant had sufficient probable cause to conduct the arrest. On appeal, they argued that, well, maybe all the officers involved directly had that probable cause. They had not communicated that probable cause to the person, the supervisor, who made the call. So they really were changing their entire theory of defense. And there's no such switch in this case. We always argued that it was this seizure before the flight under a Mendenhall totality of circumstances approach. As far as stopping anyone who may have been a witness, in this case, while Mr. Harris-Rory indicated he heard the shots, arguably anyone surrounding, gunshots are loud, would have heard. And I'm not sure that the police could stop any single person at all in the vicinity that may have heard the shots. So that's what I have.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.